are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 6th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, is going to be with us to talk about the crisis in Saudi Arabia, the crisis brewing between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and what it all means for the greater picture, the larger security picture in the Middle East. Also, Omar Aziz of Yale University, journalist, is going to join us to talk about his piece, Sam Harris's Detestable Crusade, how his latest anti-Islam track reveals the bankruptcy of his ideas. Preload your tweets and phone calls, Harris cult members. But it is actually going to be a really important conversation, and there's bigger implications from that as well. Did North Korea detonate a hydrogen bomb? Possibly. A lot of people are questioning that claim, actually. People who have more expertise on hydrogen bombs than me. I'll turn to Matt for the final answer on that. Bernie Sanders in New York calling for real reform on Wall Street, not tinkering around the edges like Hillary, or simply allowing Wall Street to go back to destroying the global economy like the Republicans. Donald Trump released a pretty amazing ad with some pretty amazing footage, and not for the reasons that you might suspect. Or maybe you might have suspected it. False images and Donald Trump ad. Not really that surprising. Was Obama really crying at his press conference announcing his executive order on guns? Conservatives have ideas about this, and I have ideas about their ideas. We'll get to that in the fun half, along with your calls and IMs. You can take me down. Folks, we're going to get to Steve Cook in just a moment. I think you know all the ways you can support this show. I'll give a bigger pitch for it before we go to the fun half. Really quickly, I just want to say Happy New Year to everybody. I still think we're within range here. So Happy New Year, Matt.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Kelly.
Happy New Year.
Was it good for everybody?
Mine was fantastic.
Awesome.
Pretty good.
Pretty good?
Yep.
Good. I think 2016 is off to a solid start. I hope it's been going well for everybody else. And we will be right back to talk with Stephen Cook of the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking about the crisis in Saudi Arabia. We'll be right back on the Majority Report.
Pure roast.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Steve Cook. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Steve, great to be talking with you.
Terrific to talk to you, Michael.
So, Steve, I want to start. We've been sort of hearing in the news over the past several days this crisis kind of emanating out of Saudi Arabia, which obviously is compounding sort of multi-track crises happening in the Middle East, frankly. Over this past weekend, there was a mass execution in Saudi Arabia. According to Saudi officials, actually most of the people executed were Al-Qaeda operatives of some sort. And then there was the killing of at least a handful of essentially Shia human rights activists. Of course, Saudi Arabia is a radical Sunni state, very conservative Sunni state. And the civil rights situation for Shia Muslims is far from optimal, to put it diplomatically. What do you think from a Saudi perspective? And again, we're obviously not justifying this. It's quite clear on a basic human rights level that this was atrocious. But what is driving what seems to be the kind of anxiety of the Saudi monarchy right now? It seems like a scared kingdom.
Yeah, it is a kingdom that is having an extraordinarily difficult time adjusting to and dealing with everything that is going on around it. And this is something that's been going on since at least 2010, when the uprisings began around the region. Understand that Saudi Arabia is the kind of quintessential status quo power in the Middle East, which is why, despite the vast differences in values and ideals that Americans hold dear and those that the Saudi leadership, the House of Saud, hold, we find ourselves in a strategic alliance with them because we are also a status quo power in the region. That means the rules of the game in the Middle East tend to favor the United States and Saudi Arabia. Now, from their perspective, first of all, this kind of execution is something that's fairly routine in Saudi Arabia. Last year, Saudi Arabia was, I think, the third biggest executioner after China and Iran. Although, if you think about it in terms of population per capita execution, the Saudis and the Iranians are way ahead of the way ahead of the Chinese. But as you point out, in addition to Al-Qaeda and allegedly ISIS operatives, they did execute a number of Shia activists, including Sheikh Nimr Nimr, which was, it's hard to believe, not designed to create a response from the Iranians. And this is kind of seeping into what else you want to talk about, but the Iranians view much of what is going on in the region, the turmoil around them, which they are a part of creating, I should say, but they see it quite differently. They see it as Iranian meddling, Iran seeking to take advantage of turmoil in the Arab world to alter the rules of the game in the region, specifically in the Gulf region. And the Saudis don't like American policy. And so they've done a lot, and I would include this execution is a way of, one, registering their disapproval, and two, trying to undermine American policy.
Right, and that's with regard to negotiating the nuclear deal with Iran, as well as disagreements over Syria. We'll get to that in a moment. But I think the other aspect of this that is interesting to me, and I want to know your take on it, But it seems to me that, you know, part of the internal balance of Saudi Arabia, and there's, and the internal contradictions that it exposes, basically, is that you have the House of Saud that, you know, is a monarchy that runs the country. There's a lot of factions within the family itself. There's there's more or less conservative and radical factions, more or less reformist factions within the context of Saudi. So, you know, I guess take the word reformist with a grain of salt, but nonetheless within context, more reformist. And then, you know, there's also just the, you know, sort of expected hypocrisies of an enormously wealthy and powerful and insulated family that presides over an incredibly closed and conservative society. The alliance between the House of Saud and the Wahhabi religious establishment, which sort of anchors Saudi Arabia in a very extremist form of religion and also sort of sanctifies the leadership, it seems to me that part of the dangers that maybe they perceive is that if you follow the logic of some of the ideology of Saudi Arabia, it does lead, at least ideologically, to something like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. So are they playing this kind of balancing act where they're saying, okay, we're getting it from both sides. We're angry at Iran. We want to register our displeasure and we want to maintain the status quo in the region. And then at the same time, we are also seeing our almost our, at least our intellectual progeny in some respects, turn back on us. And this has been happening at least since the 1990s. So that when we kill, you know, Al-Qaeda or ISIS operatives, and we go after extremist Sunnis, we have to keep soothing our base, so to speak, by repressing Shia as well. I mean, does that dynamic play out as well?
There is this duality in Saudi Arabia, absolutely, that you point out. The deal with the Wahhabi religious establishment, I think it is not... To be more subtle about it, I think that the Wahhabi religious establishment and the House of Saud at this point need each other, and that there is a tremendous amount of consensus building that goes on behind the scenes before they take certain kinds of actions. But you're spot on in the sense that the Saudis have been sort of caught betwixt and between here and have been unable to decide until recently who was the bigger problem. The Islamic State and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, or the Iranians and the kind of sectarian lens through which they see the rest of the region. And if you listen to what some within the Saudi clerical establishment say about the Shia and the kind of general institutional kind of discrimination against the Shia in the country, it is clear that the kind of rhetoric that is being used serves similar kinds of purposes in a grotesque form when it comes to the Islamic State. They are in ways creating their own Al-Qaeda, their own Islamic State, fighters. And it obviously it's quite polarizing in Saudi society. You know, let's put it this way. I'd rather stand in the middle of Riyadh and declare my Judaism than say I was Shia.
Right. Wow. That says a sort of mind-bending amount.
Snarky and whatever, yeah, but I think true. It drives home the point about the Shia in Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. And really, the context in which, you know, part of this story that we shouldn't overlook really is just a civil and human rights story and the crisis of abuse of civil and human rights in Saudi Arabia. Let's get to the Iran piece. Does this move signify, and obviously Iran's response has been, outrage, the Ayatollah promised divine vengeance against Saudi Arabia, the Saudi embassy in Tehran was sort of overrun with people. The Saudis ended up closing it down because they essentially accused the Iranian authorities of sort of letting their embassy get ransacked, which, you know, frankly, is a legitimate suspicion.
I think there's historical precedent for that. Yeah,
yeah, there's some, right.
I believe that.
Really, Iran is disrespectful of people's embassies? I don't know where you I don't know where you get that from, Steve, but you're the Council of Foreign Relations guy, not me. So, obviously Iran has that history. What I guess very specifically in the Iran-Saudi dynamic, and then we'll pivot from there, what is the next natural step from this new amplification of tension? Because it does seem like, you know, at least practically speaking, it's not as if Iran and Saudi Arabia have not been fighting proxy wars, you know, sniping at each other diplomatically. In some respects, I think Saudi Arabia, quietly has probably been, you know, just as intense, if not maybe even more potentially covertly effective in trying to undermine the nuclear deal with Iran than Israel in the United States. So what practically does this really change? And I mean, I guess the question with the subtext is this going to get a lot worse?
Well, I wouldn't expect, a ground conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia. That's just not the way either of these countries operate. Of course, there is the example of the Iran-Iraq War, but that was a very long time ago. What you can expect is, and you pointed to it, with the proxy wars going on in Yemen, proxy wars going on in Syria, obviously, and Iraq, quite frankly, right. That both countries have the ability and the resources to step up those conflicts. Yemenis, Syrians, and Iraqis will continue to suffer over this conflict that's going on between these two big powers in the region over who's going to establish the rules of the game in the region. And that's where I expect it'll happen. The Saudis view Yemen in particular as an existential threat to Saudi Arabia. They perceive it, and they perceive their fight as, and this is a direct quote from a senior Saudi official directly to me, that they are fighting for the free world in Yemen, that they are opposed to the Hezbollahization of Yemen. And this is, quite frankly, it's in their backyard. It's on the Arabian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. But I think they're so pathologically focused on Iran and that Iran speaks for Shia in the entire region that they don't recognize the fact that much of what they're doing in Yemen is making their predictions as kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. If anything was going to turn Yemen into, the Hezbollahization of Yemen, it was this kind of ill-fated military operation on the part of the Saudis, which they proved they're not very good at into Yemen.
Well, yeah, and just to focus on Yemen for just another moment, I think that not only has it been ill-fated, I think, again, it's important, I think, particularly to always sort of register the as you have, the enormous human rights consequences and humanitarian consequences of what Saudi Arabia has done in Yemen. The other kind of question about the Hezbollahization of Yemen that's worth considering is that, we're talking about the Houthis in Yemen, which are perceived of as sort of the Yemeni equivalent of Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed proxy in Yemen. And I think the other problem that the Saudis have maybe sort of run into is determining whether how much does a group like that just simply serve as a proxy and how much is there sort of genuine local and organic support.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Go ahead.
I think that's in their kind of pathological view of the exercise of Iranian power and it being a sectarian issue. The Saudis have miscalculated on this point. Right. And they shouldn't have. I mean, they've been fighting the Houthis since the 1930s.
Right.
So, this is not something, but they have convinced themselves that the current round, and this goes back to actually 2009, that this is something related to Iranian manipulations. And it's the same narrative when it came to the uprising in Bahrain.
Yep.
That this is Iranian manipulation. And the best that most people can tell is that what has happened is these things happen spontaneously, and the Iranians do what they always do, is they seek to use it. They use these cleavages to their advantage. And as a, kind of revolutionary state in the region would do. That's not to excuse their behavior, but that's a truer picture of what the regional dynamics are rather than the way the Saudis portray it.
Well, and it's a core strategic miscalculation, because if you're dealing with, you know, that's relatively less complicated. This group here is just an agent of another country, Iran, so help us get rid of it, versus, you know, Iran is amplifying and trying to capitalize on your genuine sort of politics and grievance. And if they keep making that confusion and that miscalculation, it's going to keep leading to these disastrous results. Let's go to, you know, you mentioned Iraq. Let's just do Iraq and Syria really briefly before we sort of sum up with the U.S. role in all of this. It's, you know, clearly in Iraq and Syria, this is where, you know, most primarily the ISIS example comes out. And we know that in terms of Syria, we know, I think most people know that Iran has been a fervent backer of the Assad regime. And the Saudis have supported a variety of radical Sunni groups throughout the course of what is now obviously civil war. It seemed like as a result of that recalibration that you talked about earlier of Saudi Arabia sort of looking in their own backyard and saying, well, wait a second, we don't want these guys to start coming at us. There was some sense of, okay, we need to be a little bit more synchronized here, at least with regards to ISIS. And there has been a sort of moving forward of the diplomatic process somewhat in Syria. How does this, and let me include Iraq in this as well. The Iraqi army took back Ramadi. There's been some progress there. Does this sort of undo the small steps of progress that there have been made in sort of synchronizing against ISIS in the last couple of months?
Well, it depends on how you define progress. I think that the Iraqi military, just as by way of example, to give you a sense of the way the Saudis look at things, the Iraqi military retaking Ramadi with our help is an advantage. It's a plus for Prime Minister Abadi and his government, which they see as a Shia government aligned with Iran,
right,
despite the fact that the Saudis just opened their embassy in Baghdad once again. And it's also part of a broader narrative about the United States aligning itself with Shia in the region. So I think that overall, there have been a number of things that are a setback to the fight against ISIS and trying to bring the Syria conflict to an end, and this is certainly one of them, the execution of Sheikh Nimr and the other and other Shia in Saudi Arabia. The problem is that it's, you know, do we say this in polite company, because the Saudis are a partner and ally of the United States, the Saudis have a very similar outlook as ISIS when it comes to the Shia.
Right.
At least their clerical establishment does, and as we discussed, there is this symbiotic relationship between the House of Saud and the clerical establishment. So I think that we've noticed that the Saudis have been less enthusiastic about taking on ISIS. They've been preoccupied with Yemen for sure, but it's clear by what they've done and what they've said, despite having executed al-Qaeda people and ISIS people and what have you, that they've made the determination that Iran is the bigger threat. And that makes it that more difficult to resolve problems in Iraq and Syria. And that's why, I mean, from my perspective, I think what goes on around the table at Vienna is so totally divorced from what all of the players are doing on the battlefield that, it makes it almost irrelevant.
Right. So, you know, this sort of leads to a provocative question that I would have, which is that,
provocative question.
Yeah, I always for you, Steve. But the real, question is if, and look, you know, this is the Middle East, and I think it's always, I mean, it's important to, this is in a very sort of real politic mode. But if the Saudis are so concerned that the United States is recalibrating in favor of the Shia and in favor of Iran, which again I think is a deluded view and sort of reflects their neurosis to some degree. But you know, I think the question from a U.S. perspective starts to become, well, look, in Syria, we've decided that ISIS is the greatest threat emanating out of Syria. that that's the sort of overriding security concern. Over the last, you know, at least since September 11th, obviously, it has been this variant of groups like Al-Qaeda and now ISIS, and everything that's emanated out of that very narrow Wahhabist ideology. I want to always make that distinction. It's not about Islam, but it is about a fanatical revivalist tradition, which has sort of mutated and turned violent with groups now ranging from, you know, Syria to Pakistan to Nigeria. And we've said that this is the sort of overarching security concern. Now, with regards to Iran, we have disagreements, and we, you know, we might dislike any number of things Iran or Hezbollah does, but just from a purely strategic, pragmatic point of view, aren't we moving to a point where we could also legitimately say, if the Saudis are concerned that we're not being loyal friends, we have to actually really be concerned not only just how loyal Saudi Arabia is, but really where the core threats are emanating from that region that migrate back to us. And it seems much right. more on the Saudi balance sheet than the Iranian balance sheet.
Well, this is the kind of conversation that needs to be had in Washington. This is a fight that, given the way in which the region has turned and the flux that it's in, here is the opportunity to have that conversation. And that conversation is not just about the Middle East. It's also about important domestic issues here in the United States.
Yeah.
And they're intertwined. And we've started to have that conversation in fits and starts. Obviously, the Obama administration views what's happened as an opportunity, does not see sees the threats, I think, emerging from multiple different places in the region, and has wanted to have a more nuanced view and understand the change that's happening in the region, does not always, doesn't line up with the way in which we've always done business in the region. And there's a very strong pull to kind of pull back, and that if we could just get more involved and do things better, we're just going to set things back the way they were when it was easier. Iran bad, Saudi Arabia good, and so on. And it doesn't really work that way with the kind of multi-vector threats that are happening. These are both, in a lot of ways, bad actors, I think, if we put out the balance sheet. And that's the fundamental problem with the United States and our policy in the region right now, and that is the inability to kind of negotiate, or the difficulty of negotiating between two bad actors and determining which threat is more important to the other. And of course, you have different groups in the United States who are putting pressure on the administration and Congress to make a decision with is one. Just look at the debates, the foreign policy debates among the presidential candidates on the Republican side, a little bit less so on the Democratic side, if only because they haven't focused as much on that issue. But this is something that I've said over and over again. We need to have a big conversation in this country about what our core interests are in the Middle East. We've defined them the same for 60 years, right. But the world has changed radically since then.
Absolutely. And as a final question, and you alluded to domestic issues, and I am curious. I mean, people have made this point for decades, but it is part of that recalibration and that shift that would make us less, you know, both intertwined with places like Saudi Arabia and indirectly Iran, and frankly would, you know, diminish the power of some of the most sort of engorging special interests that we have in the United States and around the world. I mean, is the energy at least moving somewhat away from a petro economy? Is that part of the answer to this puzzle?
Well, I think in part, but I don't think that we are going to completely disengage.
Sure.
From, because we have a kind of a broad interest in the continuation of healthy economies around the world that will be continued to be, to a large extent, as much progress as we make in alternative energies, dependent upon energy resources from this part of the world. But there is an opportunity to kind of, not disengage, but, you know, unwind things a bit, kind of think about how we can secure this region in partnership while at the same time moving away from the petro-heavy economies and transportation systems that we have. I think one of the unfortunate things about low oil prices is that, you know, there's this tendency Americans go out and buy new cars. We're going to start driving more, and then the prices go up. And so it's this kind of vicious circle in which we are continue to be intertwined with this part of the region. But I think we'll always be interested as long as we have a global interest in a healthy global economy.
And as long as we have an inhabitable planet, which I guess is the other subtext of all of these conversations.
Right.
But
well, that's entirely different.
Right. Absolutely. But Steve Cook, as always, I really appreciate your insight, your time. And I will talk with you soon, my friend. Thanks so much. Steve Cook, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Take care. Okay, folks. We are going to get right back with Omar Aziz to talk about this piece that he wrote in Salon because we're running a few minutes behind. So let's just, what do we got? We got some Nas. Let's get to the Nas. All right, we'll be right back.
Nas, you ready? Ready when you all pray?
Yeah.
All right.
Freedom of jail, clips inserted. A baby's being born, same time a man is murdered. The beginning and end. As far as rap goes, it's only natural. I explain my plateau and also what defines my name. First it was nasty, but times have changed. Actually now I'm the artist, but hardcore, my signs for pain. I spent time in the game, kept my mind on fame. Saw fiends shoot up and do lines of saw my close friend shot, flatlining my same. That depends, carry Mac-10s to practice my aim. On rooftops, tape CD covers the trees. Line a barrel up with your weak pitch. And squeeze street scriptures for lost souls in the crossroads to the corner thugs hustling for cars that cost dough to the big dogs living large taking it light pushing big toys getting nice join your life is what you make it suicide few tried to take it belt tied around their neck and jail cells naked heaven and hell rap legend presence is felt and of course NAS are the letters that spell
Nas like life or death. I'm a rapper. My poetry's deep I never felt Nas like
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Omar Aziz. He is a writer and a law candidate at the Yale University School of Law, and his recent piece for Salon, Sam Harris's Detestable Crusade, How His Latest Anti-Islam Tract Reveals the History, the bankruptcy of his ideas appeared last week in Salon. Omar, I look forward to this conversation, and I also am aware that you and I are going to be involved together in so many threads on Twitter that it's just going to be mind-blowing. So I welcome you to the show, Omar.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this piece, because I think that, you know, we've had this sort of Sam Harris conversation on this show a number of times. It's fascinated me on a kind of pop culture level to see the amount of devotion as almost sort of like a guru figure that he evokes in people. I don't really have a strong feeling about his sort of general ideas or his atheism, but I found his writing on Islam to be and foreign policy to be really problematic because you're dealing with really important issues and reducing them to a, you know, incredibly sort of narrow lowest common denominator under the veneer of sophistication. So that's sort of my kind of angle that I'm coming from. Explain you start your piece by talking about this sort of broader world of the Islamic Reformation Project, and you look at it as sort of a good money hustle. Explain that to us.
Yeah, let me just back up to something you said earlier about him not understanding the nuance and complexity of foreign policy and international relations. Look, these are very complicated issues, right?
Sure.
We're talking about thousands of years of history. We're talking about hundreds of years of foreign policy, power relationships, the development of secular law, the development of cultures, wars and battles within cultures and within polities. And I don't think that he actually understands that. And that's not unique to him. I mean, very often we have people who are scientists or good in the hard sciences not actually grasping or being able to understand the complexities and the nuances of the social sciences or of international relations. Some of the things Richard Dawkins has said recently about Muslims and about foreign policy, I think, betray his ignorance. On the point of reformation, I think that it is, you know, I called it a get-rich-quick scheme, and I stand by that. I think that the easiest thing I could do, and many people can do, is just present some theories, their own theories, about how those Muslims over there need to reform their religion and become enlightened like us, and make a couple arguments. I think people are going to be interested in that, because it's like it's intellectual fast food, I think, right? It feels good,
right,
to sort of spout this kind of stuff and to even think it and to write it, but I don't think it does very much. Especially for the people who actually live in the Middle East, people who live in the Muslim world writ large, and I ultimately think strategically it's counterproductive, because the violent verses in Leviticus are still there, right? The Jews and the Christians did not sort of take a razor to their holy books, and we can't expect the same to happen in Islam. And there are better strategies to, you know, induce a kind of cultural and liberal progress that are indigenous to these regions. And so the solution itself, I think, is false. I think it's intellectually shallow. I think that it's unsophisticated, and I think that it's more about making ourselves feel good and feel superior to them than it is about actually getting any kind of real solution. But it does happen to pay well. And so there's this entire industry of reforming Islam and calling for reformation of Islam that sort of sprouted in the post 9/11 era.
Right. So and actually I don't know. I mean, before we get to sort of spelling that more out, let's just sort of take care of an argument that I know will pop up sort of just automatically anytime you have this conversation, and it's this sort of very, very, very sort of aggressively rudimentary point, which is that people are going to say, have you read the Quran? Have you read the Hadiths? And, you know, Muhammad said this and the Hadith, you know, and they say that. And, you know, Sam Harris is just quoting these books. I might add, you know, as a little addendum, it's always interesting to me that Sam Harris is a guy who's sort of like half of his public statements are about being misunderstood for sort of popular general audience books he writes for sort of college-educated people, thinks that like a holy book that has thousands of years of history and is proliferated across the world can be like, you know, understood in sort of one sit-down, has always been an irony to me. But before we get to that, I just want to say, you know, what is the response to that just sort of basic point, which is that these books have some very disturbing and mean passages. They have some scientifically inaccurate passages. You know, any number of things that you could say about any of the books in the sort of Abrahamic Trinity, they're problematic, and they do indeed seem to influence some terrible ideas, whether it's misogyny or homophobia. And, you know, that's sort of all there is to it. I mean, that seems to be the sort of go-to. So before we get to the bigger and more important conversation, what's the answer to that very specifically?
Well, I mean, look, I would be the first one to acknowledge that there are violent verses in the Quran, as there are in the Torah and in the Old Testament and other religious books. The problem with that is that you basically eliminate the interpretive faculties of the people who are reading these books. The problem with that is that you eliminate the politics and what's going on in society, the brutalization of people. There's a reason why ISIS and violent jihad is centered in the Middle East, which, by the way, only makes up about 18% of the entire global Islamic population. It's because these societies have been dealing with war and with violence and with brutality for the past 50, 60 years, if not longer, and subjugation, of course, and subordination to other people's interests. But look, those verses are there, and I think that, you know, why is it, the follow-up question is that why is it that 99.9%, I don't even want to put a number on it, right, because I would have to elucidate many nines. Why is it that the majority, the vast majority of Muslims don't read, you know, don't turn to the violent verses of the Quran and go out and kill people, right? It's clearly they interpret their book, which is, by the way, like all holy books, full of contradictions, full of parables, right, full of stories, and that they use that to help them basically with life and to make sense of this disorder and this anarchy that we call life. And the absurdity of life, but there is a small minority that goes and turns to the violent verses where it's convenient. But I think reducing it to that, reducing it to there is a jihad verse or a sword verse here or there, I think what you basically do is that you say that these verses and the people who interpret them and use that to mean kill as many people as you want, I think that you basically say that they are representative of Muslims and Islam, which is a dangerous and I think wrong-headed conclusion. The vast majority of Muslims, when they turn to their Qurans, and by the way, I should say that the vast majority of Muslims don't understand Quranic Arabic because it's a classical text.
Right.
They themselves do not speak Arabic because they're not Arabs. And so for them, Islam is not just this text that Sam Harris says, right? Look, there's this text, and we're all robots, or Muslims are all robots that are sort of processing this and making decisions about life and death as the days go by, right? I mean, it's a very Orientalist and a very Orientalist conception of these people as almost savages. But Islam is much more than just a text. It's a tradition that has a history, that has a culture, that has arts around it, that has this plethora of understandings and interpretations of law, right, of how to deal with people, of society. There's an Islamic form of socialism, right? One of the very first welfare states was done under the first caliphate. And in fact, Islam is the only religion that mandates a redistributive tax on the rich to assist the poor. And so there's this entire corpus, this entire world that, I don't want to use the term new atheist, but many people on the right just reduce to a text and they turn it into an instruction manual and they basically highlight or point to the savagery and brutality in a very Orientalist or neo-Orientalist kind of way of the people who read them. And that's problematic.
Right. So actually, so there's some things to tease apart there that are really, really important. And it gets naturally sort of into the broader strategic point that you're pointing to about how any quote-unquote reformation project and policy reform and everything else and dealing with the human rights crises is going to involve pulling on indigenous sources. And so the first point you're making, which is crucial and I want you to sort of elaborate on, is that within the Islamic tradition itself, writ large, globally, there is everything from, you know, mystical and contemplative practices to literary traditions to theories on power, theories on economic accountability. When you wrote this, it reminded me actually of Amartya Sen, who I always recommend that people look at, who did some work on sort of anchoring ideas of at least not democracy in the sense that we might use it in terms of a liberal democracy, but democracy in the sense of accountability of the people over the powerful as being a global value, which you can find expressed in text in China, texts in India, texts in the Islamic tradition, African politics, that this is not a singular European phenomenon. So that's really important. So I'd like you to expand on the examples within Islamic history and culture, and then maybe pivot into how some of this, for lack of a better word, we'll keep saying it, Reformation work. What would the Reformation work look like that was really rooted in the Islamic tradition and not projected from outside of it and lecturing it and sort of, you know, holding these bigoted, simplistic views?
Yeah. Well, you know, in the piece I mentioned, the House of Wisdom and, you know, the repositories of learning that existed in the Middle East in Islam's so-called Golden Age, where there were translations of Aristotle and vast additions made to our understanding of physics and science and optometry and political economy and just the entire corpus of the social sciences and the hard sciences, including the scientific method itself. There was a proto-scientific method that began there. And many people on Twitter said, well, he is going back to the 9th century or the 10th century as if adding context was a bad thing. So let me fast forward a little bit and say that, in the 17th and 18th century, there was this realization that the Islamic, by the elites of the Muslim world, that is the Islamic universe, the Islamic polity, had fallen behind Christendom. that the West, which was, you know, ascendant for maybe 200 years before that, had taken over in terms of science, in terms of military success, in terms of how they governed. And so, you know, the Ottoman Turks, for example, and other political elites tried to understand what was it that was holding the Islamic world back, and they began instituting a number of reforms, right, including consultative government, including open exchanges between people. And intellectuals at the time were actually, you know, this question was front and center of their mind. You know, names like Sir Syed Ahmed Khan in India, names like Jamaluddin al-Afghani in Afghanistan and in Persia, people who were very well-versed both in the European classics and the Islamic classics, grappling with the question of how to reconcile Islam with modernity, right? And then you have this, basically this right-wing fanatic named Abdul Wahab who comes and says, it doesn't matter what any of the elites or any of history says, you have to return and interpret the text as literally as possible, and he essentially launches a crusade against other Muslims. And that is, his ideology is the same one that Saudi Arabia today and that ISIS today share. It's a very right-wing and a very fanatical one. So the first point is that this idea of, you know, making Islam compatible, or trying to grapple with this question of modernity and Islam, is not a new one, right? Majid Nawaz or Sam Harris or any of these guys aren't the first ones to raise this issue. Ayaan Hirsi Ali is not the first one to raise this issue. It goes back 200, 300 years to, you know, to the root of the Islamic world. The second point is that when it comes to reformation of Islam, it has to be done with support of the indigenous communities, right? So domestically, first of all, I should say that as soon as someone labels themselves a reformer, I get very anxious and very nervous, because I think it takes a little bit of hubris to say that I know what it takes for you know, a quarter of the world's population to become enlightened.
Particularly, right? If it's not even your tradition. I mean, you know, some of these people, like, I appreciate how you wrote about Ayaan Hirsi Ali really disaggregating her own narrative and personal suffering and trauma from, as distinct from her ideas. Those are two different tracks. But, I mean, and, you know, Majid Nawaz obviously is a Muslim and in sort of wrestling with these issues. But, you know, this sort of Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins project, there's some level of just kind of like, I guess it's hubris. It also seems delusional to me. Like, I never looked at the child sex abuse scandals in Catholicism, which I'm not Catholic, but Catholicism is closer to me. I never thought, you know what? I got to find some Catholics, priests to partner up with, and tell them how to redesign the Catholic Church. That's my intellectual project. It seems delusional.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Harris's rejoinder here would be that Islam is uniquely a threat, which I think is a problematic idea as well. But look, even with Nawaz or any of these other guys, if you want to reform a community, if you want to progress around liberal egalitarian lines, I think it's very important, you know, as a prerequisite to your project, that you be rooted in that community, mm-hmm. right? So there are imams, there are scholars, there are community activists rooted in the Islamic community in America and certainly abroad. And American Muslims are by far and large, at least in my experience, some of them probably the most liberal Muslims in the world. And the best integrated as well, especially compared to Europe. So the first point is that if you want to induce cultural liberalism in a certain community, if you want to reform it, if you want to improve it, right, if you want to use those terms, you have to be rooted in that community, right? So Majid Nawaz is just—it's simply a fact that he's not well rooted in the community. He's not received
by Majid Nawaz is a Muslim activist and writer in Britain who's co-written a book with Sam Harris on this quote unquote Reformation project. Just so everybody knows who he is. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so, you know, he's not rooted in the community, right? I mean, there are people who are going and doing this work every single day, right? Let's just be clear about that. In Britain, in Europe, in the Middle East, in the United States, in Canada, there are people who've been working with Muslim communities and Muslim youth before 9/11, right? Before this became a sexy topic.
Right.
Number two is that if you want to talk about reform abroad, if you want to talk about reforming, say, the Arab world and their ideas, or if you know the Middle East, the South Asia, I think that a far a far more efficacious strategy would be to support the leftist and progressive parties in opposition that exist.
Right. And sort of makes sense.
Yeah, and these are people who, when they do come to power, and I should say that before the religious right in the Middle East and in South Asia started coming to power around the 60s and the 70s, the dominant ideology was a leftist socialist one, an egalitarian one. You can go and look at the foundational documents of a country like Bangladesh or Pakistan, and you see you see actual reference to the word social justice, or you see reference to the word secularism in the case of Bangladesh. And so these are not ideas that are alien to the Middle East and to the Muslim world. And there are political parties that have existed in the Middle East since before these countries won independence that have been pushing for egalitarian and liberal ideals that Western reformists would want to implement. And when they come to power, and they haven't had an opportunity to come to power because of violence and bloodshed and authoritarianism that too many times Western governments have supported, when they come to power, the cultural change that they will implement democratically will be A, rooted in the society and the countries that they come from, and B, will be far more enduring because it will be political change that's organically elected. And so instead of spouting this stuff from afar, I think those are the people that we need to be supporting and make sure that we're critical enough about our own foreign policy misadventures when those happen.
Absolutely. And I just want to just note before I get to the final question here, even just having this most basic, rudimentary historical overview that we can do here, you're already having a conversation where there is no one in this terrain that denies the horrific brutality of or dangers of a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda. There is no one who opposes liberal and progressive efforts on women's rights, on human rights, on gay, lesbian, transgender rights in any of these places that I'm aware of that are in these conversations. And as soon as all you're doing, though, is expressing that this hasn't been some stagnant state existing since the foundation of Islam, that the right in many respects in the Middle East, you could even not direct parallels, but you could draw some parallels with the rise of the right in Europe and the United States, the religious backlash that happened globally. You see religious and revivalism even in a place like Burma in Buddhist communities. As soon as you start thinking historically and you start sort of knowing what you're talking about, you immediately get into a much more challenging conversation, but a much more fruitful one and a much more sort of policy-driven one. And I really, really appreciate that you've pointed this out in your piece and in this interview. The final question I have is, you mentioned earlier this work is sort of intellectual fast food. And it seems like the thing that annoys me, even beyond all of the sort of wrong-headedness and bad policy, is this function of a kind of public intellectualism that is exemplified by this kind of work, which, as you say, it just sort of walks people through a process of confirming their prejudice. There's nothing even as unsettling as needing to, as an example, read a history book, because why would you need to do any footwork when your prejudices can just sort of be confirmed in this sort of glib and overarching way? And it seems like so much of the work in this area just sort of ends up being reduced to that.
Yeah, and I end the piece with a quote from Mencken, H.L. Mencken, American writer, and he says that the job of the journalist, and I would extend that to all thinkers, intellectuals, even pundits, although they cheapen the work of intellectualism, the job of this profession of people is to stand in permanent opposition. And to me, that means stand in permanent opposition to the powers that be, to those who want to use propaganda to induce or propagandize misinformation among the public, and certainly those who stand for racist and bigoted viewpoints, who sort of work in the currency of ignorance. And I think that, you know, there was an ideal of a public intellectual, particularly in America, and I think Noam Chomsky today embodies that, who did speak truth to power and who did understand that power already knows what the truth is and wants to lie about it, who did ultimately stand with the downtrodden. Edward Said was another example of this. He thought that the intellectual's role was ultimately one to, the intellectual had to remain an amateur in the sense that never never allying with the powerful, and that entire category of people has been reduced, and now we have pundits on TV yelling at each other, and people writing books that don't really get to the heart of the issues that are ultimately ahistorical. And I think that bringing that back, hopefully not. I mean, this is not my project at all, but I'd like to see, you know, an intellectual environment fostered and created where we can have serious debates, where we can steep our arguments in history and in philosophy and in politics, without reducing them to some kind of monocausal analysis about this religion being really violent and therefore these people are very violent and brutal, which is ultimately a disservice both to the people we want to help and, I think, to our own minds and to the public.
That's really, really well put. And, you know, Omer, I'm sure that we have misrepresented Sam Harris, I have no doubt. And I look forward to all of those tweets and comment threads. But no, I think that these are really, really important topics. And I really, really appreciated the context you give around it. And thanks so much for your time today, Omer Aziz.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Okay, everybody, we are going to go to the fun half, where we will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We're going to take your IMs. We're going to talk about Obama crying and the conspiracies about Obama crying. We're going to talk maybe about Bernie Sanders and real Wall Street reform. And we're going to play some Ted Cruz ads and a Donald Trump ad. So there's a lot to do in the fun half. I can't find my sound sheet. I hope I can find it. Become a member of the Majority Report today. That's what sustains the show and allows it to exist. I found it. That's really as simple as that. If you appreciate the show and you benefit from the show and you profit from the show, and you can do it, please join us. It's less than a cup of coffee a day. Write us a review on iTunes. That helps us with the iTunes algorithm that gets us in front of more eyeballs. More people can find out about the show. And even if you're a member, subscribe to us on iTunes because that helps too. And it will not in any way interfere with your member feed or anything like that. It'll just help us with our numbers. Use the Amazon link to do all of your Amazon shopping if you shop on Amazon. Obviously, go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. It's a blend that's so good that apparently there's a cafe in upstate New York that serves it, and they don't even necessarily know about the show. Download the Majority Report app. You can follow us Twitter at majority.fm. Like us on Facebook. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Harass and bug your friends about the show. Just generally be annoying in the promotion of this product. No, I'm just playing. But if you can become a member, that would be great. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We will see you in the fun half.